Good evening.
This evening I'd like to say something about the nature of poetry in general. That is, I'd like to say what sort of thing poetry is. And I'd also like to talk about where we are now in poetry. That is, I'd like to say something about contemporary directions in poetry. I think it's true that over the last 15 or 20 years there has been a revival of interest in poetry. Still, there are a good many people who have trouble with it. Now, to them, it seems to be a kind of absurd business, a precious, pointless, elaborate, perhaps a dull occupation for reader as well as writer. They resent having to read it or having to listen to it. Now, I think the attitude of such people is a little bit like the attitude of a man who has been living in a world where people use their legs only to walk or to run, and who suddenly encounters someone dancing. What would he make of the person dancing? The chances are, I think, that he would be puzzled or bored. He might even be angry. His anger then would be a result of all the difficult effort he expended learning how to walk effortlessly, learning how to walk well, to walk like a man, to walk without revealing himself, perhaps. In any case, the dance would seem to him either an inefficient kind of walking or, at worst, an affected kind of walking. Now, similarly, I think a good many people are bored or irritated by poetry because they mistake it for something else. Now, all of us live in a practical age. We live in an age of prose. It's an age of factual information which looks forward to practical results. It's no wonder, then, that some people are badly prepared to read poetry with any pleasure. They read it badly because they read it as though it were a bad kind of prose. They complain about it. They say, the writer won't come out and say what he means. He uses figures of speech, sometimes very far-fetched ones. He seems unwilling to be clear. And then finally, when you do get what he's trying to say, what good is it? What can you do with it? And if you can't do anything with it, how is poetry supposed to make you a better person or a wiser person? What, after all, is poetry? Well, that's an old and a difficult question. And it would be foolhardy, I think, to try to provide a simple answer which would cover all the possibilities. However, I think it's worth trying to answer in a simple way. Let's say, then, that poetry does not give us information. It does not tell us what something is. It does, on the other hand, tell us what something is like. Let me illustrate that simply by calling attention first to a literal statement which gives us information, which tells us what something is, and a couple of figurative statements which tell us what something is like. Suppose a man enters the room and I point to him and I say, he is my father. Now, we're assuming that the man who has entered the room is my actual father. Okay, I point to him and I say, he is my father. This is a literal statement. It tells who or what something or someone is. It takes the label, father, and it pins it on a particular person. Let's take the next step now and change that literal statement so that it reads differently. It now reads, my father is like a bear. This is a simile. It compares my father to a bear. It borrows some of the qualities of the bear and assigns them to my father. In a sense, it tells what my father is like. However, it's important to notice that it tells what my father is like to me, That is how my father seems to me. Let's go a further step in the direction of the imaginative and away from the literal and employ a metaphor. And let's say, instead of saying, my father is like a bear, let's say, my father is a bear. A metaphor is a little bit like a simile that has the courage of its convictions. Instead of simply sitting back and saying A is like B, it makes a more courageous movement, and it says A is B. My father is a bear. Now there's a. I think we ought to go a step further and consider an even more extreme kind of statement. It's what's called suppressed metaphor. That is, we take one of the two terms of the metaphor, in this case the first one, my father, and we simply leave it out. And we proceed to make a statement about the bear. And we say, not he is my father, not my father is like a bear, not my father is a bear, but the bear comes home at 5 o'clock and demands his dinner. The bear comes home at 5 o'clock and demands his dinner. Notice, this again tells us what it's like to be in that household, perhaps what it's like to be a child in that household, when the father comes home at 5 o'clock and demands his dinner. Systematic prose, then, gives us logical or scientific information. It tells us what something is. Poetry, on the other hand, tells us what something is like. It gives us the actual felt quality of experience. Let me try another way of defining it. Let's say that in one way or another, we are all hungry for meaning. That is, we all want to make some kind of sense out of our lives. Now, philosophy tries to tell us what kind of sense we can make out of our lives. It tries to discover a meaning in life, or it tries to impose a meaning on life. But philosophy arrives at meaning by going around experience. Poetry, on the other hand, precisely because it tells us what things are really like, poetry creates meanings, makes sense then, it creates meanings in the very terms in which those meanings are encountered or invented in life. Let me see if I can give a concrete example of what I mean when I say that poetry creates meaning in the very terms in which meaning is encountered or experienced or invented in life. Here's a little poem by William Carlos Williams, the great American poet, who incidentally was also a practicing doctor in New Jersey. Here's a little poem by Dr. Williams called The Young Housewife. Now, if the speaker of this poem had wanted to present the meaning of his life in general philosophical terms, he might have said something like this. He might have said, my life is a tension between my activity as a practical moral man, my activity as a doctor, and on the other hand, my work as a poet. However, in this poem, he doesn't do that. He doesn't speak that way. The poem is called The Young Housewife. This is the way it goes. At 10 a.m., the young housewife moves about in negligee behind the wooden walls of her husband's house. I pass solitary in my car. That's the first stanza. In the second stanza, he pauses in his practical life, he pauses in the life of prose, so to speak, to compare, to analogize, to poetize. He says, here's the second stanza. Then again, she comes to the curb to call the iceman, fishman, and stands shy, uncorseted, tucking in stray ends of hair, and I compare her to a fallen leaf. And then in the third and final stanza, the two lives, the doctor and the poet, what we might call the practical and the aesthetic, these two lives are brought together for a moment in a kind of lively equilibrium. The noiseless wheels of my car rush with a crackling sound over dried leaves as I bow and pass smiling. That's the end of the poem. Notice that there is no statement in the poem to the effect that my life is a tension between one kind of activity and another kind of activity. That tension is not talked about explicitly in the poem. It is presented in the poem in the very terms in which it is experienced. That is, in terms of driving by the home of an attractive woman, seeing her come to the curbstone, comparing her in his own mind to a fallen leaf, and then finally driving on in a kind of Mandarin-like mood. So much for poetry in general. Poetry tells us what something is really like, and in so doing, it creates meaning in the very terms in which meaning is actually experienced in life. Where are we now in poetry? That is, what's been happening in the last 10 years or so in poetry in America? I think we've been having a romantic or lyric revival, and I think we are leaving behind a body of work which I want to call dramatic as opposed to lyric. Let me explain what I mean by this difference a little bit more fully. The writing of poetry seems to go, I think, in either of two directions, lyric or dramatic, each one corresponding to some major direction of the human soul. The lyric pays attention to the difficult details of experience, but it does so only in order to transcend them, that's to rise above them. The lyric wants to move from stony fact, the hard facts, to air and to music. As the great American poet Wallace Stevens put it, poetry goes from substance to subtlety. Certainly lyric poetry goes, I think, from substance to subtlety. The values of the lyric are what we ordinarily think of as romantic or expansive. Lyric poetry celebrates the self. It denies that the limits of myself are indicated by my outer skin. And with certain existentialist thinkers, the lyric writer wants to say that my human self extends through the whole area of my concern. That is, I am not limited by this skin which seems to surround me. Again, to quote Wallace Stevens, the thing I hum appears to be the rhythm of this celestial pantomime. The lyric writer then subjectivizes the object. As he writes about something, this is the object, and he gives the object his special personal coloration. So much for the lyric. Now the dramatic writer, and I want to distinguish primarily here between the lyric and the dramatic writer wants to say that even in an impersonal world like ours, the agon, or the struggle of self, matters. Let's say that he feels some kind of inner conflict, or a conflict between two attitudes or two feelings within himself. He bodies these two attitudes forth in a conflictual or dramatic structure, and in terms which will be as firm and as palpable as possible. He takes precise account of human limits, of human limitation, and he traces the difficult means whereby human identity may with difficulty be achieved. Whereas the lyric writer subjectivizes the object, the dramatic writer objectivizes the subject, giving us, in the words of another important American poet, Ivor Winters, the taste of air becoming body. Winters has a poem about the bear. He thinks of the poet as a bear coming out of his cave in springtime. And he says, the bear mounts into the spring, upon his tongue the taste of air becoming body. So much then for the difference between the lyric and dramatic. Now, I think the so-called modern poetry, which developed a great reputation for difficulty in past years, and in which a whole generation of readers was schooled by the so-called new criticism, was of this dramatic variety. Its range was very remarkable. It could range from John Crow Ransom's elegant exercises in tone to the powerful work of a writer like his student, that of his, the work of his student Robert Lowell, whereas Ransom treated what we would ordinarily think of as sentimental subjects, moving gradually to an equilibrium of attitudes toward these otherwise sentimental subjects. Robert Lowell exploited his own religious difficulties in a ferocious, elaborately constructed manner. In any case, this work, this dramatic work, inhabited a realm of difficult reconciliation. It insisted that our desires were never to be confused with the facts of experience. The catchwords of this poetry and of this criticism were irony, paradox, tension. It steered clear of what it took to be rhetoric or what it took to be easy feelings, and it appealed to the sophisticated reader's awareness of the complexities and contradictions of experience. That phrase, the complexities and contradictions of experience, I've lifted from an essay by Robert Penn Warren. It was a famous essay in defense of poetic difficulty. In that essay, Warren went so far as to compare the poet to the jiu-jitsu expert who wins by making use of the resistance of his opponent. He wins over his opponent by making use of his opponent's resistance. Although Warren insisted that poetic statement ought to carry something of the context of its own creation, that context, Warren always assumed, would be conflictual. And Warren located the poetry of the poem in no single element, but in the organized dramatic interplay of the details. It was what Warren was arguing for was a complex art of contradiction, what I have associated with dramatic as opposed to lyric poetry. Now, such a complex art of contradiction could easily decline to a learned and airless manner. What you'd get as a result would be a deliberate and cold structuring of words without much expressive force in themselves, standing, as it were, with their backs to the audience, and engaged in a conversation interesting only to themselves. The most vital tendency, I think, of the last decade has been this lyric or romantic revival, a rejection of the dramatic in the interest of more candid personal expression. Before examining some examples of this more candid personal expression, let's take one last look back at the old dramatic manner. I'd like to look at a poem by Robert Lowell called The Drunken Fisherman. Robert Lowell was educated at Harvard and Kenyon Colleges. He was a student there of John Crow Ransom's. And he has taught at Harvard and at Kenyon and at Boston University. He was a conscientious objector in the Second World War. And in 1947, he was poetry consultant at the Library of Congress. He's won many awards and honors. And he is, at the moment, regarded, I think, as a leader in American poetry. Here's a poem by Lowell called The Drunken Fisherman, and it deals with the speaker's religious difficulty, his wish to believe in Christ, and the difficulty which that belief encounters. The poem is a kind of struggle, a bitter struggle. He wants to believe, but he knows too much. In the poem, he presents himself as fishing for Christ. Ordinarily, we think of Christ as the fisher of men. That is, men can remain relatively passive, and Christ catches them. However, we're too modern now. We know too much. If we're going to make a connection with Christ, we have to fish for him. It's an excited, exacerbated kind of poetry. Here's the way it begins. Wallowing in this bloody sty, I cast for fish that pleased my eye. Truly, Jehovah's bow suspends no pots of gold to wait its ends. Only the blood-mouthed rainbow trout rose to my bait. They flopped about my canvas creel until the moth corrupted its unstable cloth. Then in the next stanza, you get a kind of catalog of equipment which the fisherman uses. A calendar to tell the day, a handkerchief to wave away the gnats, a couch unstuffed with storm, pouching a bottle in one arm, a whiskey bottle full of worms, and bedroom slacks. Are these fit terms to meet the worm whose molten rage boils in the belly of old age? Once fishing was a rabbit's foot. O wind blow cold, O wind blow hot, let suns stay in or suns step out. Life danced a jig on the sperm whale's spout. The fisher's fluent and obscene catches kept his conscience clean. Children, the raging memory drools over the glory of past pools. Now the hot river, ebbing, hauls its bloody waters into holes. A grain of sand inside my shoe mimics the moon that might undo man and creation too. Remorse, stinking, has puddled up its source. Here tantrums thrash to a whale's rage. This is the pothole of old age. Is there no way to cast my hook out of this dynamited brook? The fisher's sons must cast about when shallow waters peter out. I will catch Christ with a greased worm. And when the Prince of Darkness stalks my bloodstream to its Stygian term, on water the man-fisher walks. That's the end of the poem. I suppose at the end there's the assertion of some genuine religious possibility. On water the man-fisher walks. But the bulk of the poem really deals with the difficulty of belief. In any case, I think we'd agree that the poem is written in a difficult, heavily symbolic, almost clotted style. By 1957, Robert Lowell, who was the virtuoso of this old style, was already embarking on a new one. Looking back on his early work, he said, "Their style seemed distant, symbol-ridden, and willfully difficult." He said, "I felt my old poems hid what they were really about, and many times offered a stiff, humorless, and even impenetrable surface. He said, "My own poems seemed like prehistoric monsters dragged down into the bog and death by their ponderous armor. I was reciting what I no longer felt." And he said he felt that something like the prose of Chekhov or Flaubert was the best style for poetry. And his new manner, the new Lowell manner, was writ large in a frankly autobiographical book called Life Studies. Here's a selection, here's an excerpt from a poem in that book in which he speaks of himself. He's in his 40s. It's the 1950s. He remembers being a Catholic conscientious objector during the war and being put in prison. Here's the selection. "These are the tranquilized 50s, and I am 40. Ought I to regret my seed time? I was a fire-breathing Catholic CO and made my manic statement, telling off the state and president, and then sat waiting sentence in the bullpen beside a Negro boy with curlicues of marijuana in his hair." Theodore Rethke, another leader in American poetry, had by 1957 had already abandoned neat iambic restraint for irregular patterns which could catch the movement of the mind in its actual shift and flow. His influences there more, say, Walt Whitman and D.H. Lawrence than members of the American academic establishment. And already in 1956, Allen Ginsberg's exclamatory poem, Howl, which created such a stir here in San Francisco, revived for many, the single poem revived in a single stroke the possibility of the public rhapsodic voice. Here are the opening lines of Allen Ginsberg's Howl as Ginsberg recited them.
"I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn looking for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo in the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats floating across the tops of cities contemplating jazz, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant cool eyes hallucinating Arkansas and Blake Light tragedy among the scholars of money and war, who were expelled from the academies for crazy and publishing obscene odes on the windows of the skull, who cowered in unshaven rooms in underwear, burning their money in waste baskets and listening to the terror through the wall."
I think that record of Ginsberg reading gives some idea of the kind of tremendous impact that the poem had on the audiences to which the poem was first read in San Francisco. It was felt to be a bold, romantic gesture, a genuinely revolutionary act. It was an assault not only on American social and sexual attitudes, but on established poetic methods. Ginsberg says about it, "I suddenly turned aside in San Francisco to follow my romantic inspiration. I thought I wouldn't write a poem, but just write what I wanted to, without fear. Let my imagination go, open secrecy, and scribble magic lines from my real mind, sum up my life, something I wouldn't be able to show anybody, writ for my own soul's ear and a few other golden ears. So the first line of Howell, I saw the best minds, etc. The whole first section typed out madly in one afternoon, a huge, sad comedy of wild phrasing, meaningless images for the beauty of abstract poetry of mind, running along, making awkward combinations like Charlie Chaplin's Walk, long saxophone-like chorus lines I knew Kerouac would hear the sound of, taking off from his own inspired prose line, really a new poetry. I depended on the word who to keep the beat, a bass to keep measure, return to, and take off again onto another streak of invention. So much for Allen Ginsberg. Ginsberg's Howl, the poetry of Theodore Rethke, and the marked change in the work of Robert Lowell, all these were signs that American poetry has been changing. Now, many other instances from the recent past could be cited to substantiate the fact of change. More and more, the dramatic poetry of the 1930s and 40s seems to have been the practical application, the application in practice of a critical theory, an embattled critical theory. It was a theory which undertook the whole defense of poetry against the spirit of modern positivism. And as positivism declined in authority, it no longer seemed necessary or important to fight that battle. There's a new atmosphere then, and this new atmosphere can be felt everywhere. It's a requirement that the poem be more an action than a thing, more a personal act than a made thing. It's the feeling that the poem somehow has to be an authentic personal expression rather than a detachable object, aesthetic object, which lends itself to academic analysis. But the avant-garde in poetry is very little agreed as to the means to be employed if this new hope for poetry is to be realized. Verse practice varies very much. Criticism varies even more. Although it's impossible to predict which manner or attitude, if any, will dominate American writing during the next decade, some of the major tendencies of the moment can be discerned. Now, I should say that at the moment, the most modern-looking work is the work of Robert Creeley. Perhaps I should say modern-sounding, because for Creeley, the sound of the poem is of primary importance. Creeley was born in 1926 in Massachusetts. He went to Harvard and served in the American Field Service during the war in India and Burma. Since then, he has lived in France and Spain and Guatemala, where he has edited and taught school. He's also taught at Black Mountain College in North Carolina, where he was associated with Charles Olson and Robert Duncan, and he's done graduate work at the University of New Mexico. His most recent book is a book of poems which has enjoyed an enormous popularity called For Love. It came out in 1962. Now, Creeley takes his stand in the existential open, where he gestures without visible means of support in an exquisitely colloquial, wry, truncated, diffident, intensely self-conscious style. His rhythms and his diction owe a good deal to the practice of William Carlos Williams and his emphasis on natural speech. But in Creeley, the rhythms are heightened by a kind of near perversity of modern jazz. I think as you listen to him, you'll see what I mean by this very strong jazz-like quality. For Creeley, the emotion of the poetry is in the character of the line itself, of the line of verse, rather than something which is pointed to by the content of the line. He is enormously concerned with the structure of the line. Now here's a reading by Creeley of three poems. First one is called I Know a Man. The next one, a very funny one, is called The Lover. And the third poem is called Wait for Me.
I know a man. As I said to my friend, because I am always talking, John, I said, which was not his name, the darkness surrounds us. What can we do against it? Or else shall we? And why not buy a goddamn big car? Drive, he said, for Christ's sake, look out where you're going. That's one other funny one. This is a quote from The Life. We're talking early this morning how I've always had great admiration for people who can write poems for occasions. This is probably the last of the New England habit to be able to write beautifully accurate poems for birthdays, Christmas, even Esquire, maybe, you know, or in the New Yorker more specifically. But I'd love to be able to do this. So this is one, The Lover. What should the young man say because he is buying modest? Should he blush or not, or turn coyly his head to one side as if in the exactitude of his emotion he were not offended, were proud of what to buy a thing like that? that's as near as I get to it. Well, one other that's quote, a hard one to read. Wait for me. This is again one of my few sorties into the this kind of occasion. I'd seen someone at some point. I was my family was still in Spain and I was in New York, and some friend put into my hands, or at least it came into my hands, a book on one of these marriage counseling books. This was addressed to women, and there was a paragraph that struck me. I suppose I wanted really to understand it. I wrote it down, and it said simply that the wife's duty, or the wife's, would find herself best used in a marriage, if most comfortable, if she would give a man his manliness, provide creature comfort for him and herself, preserve essential hypocrisies, in short, make a home for herself. This was the program. And this struck me. I wanted to believe. So I later got it home, I suppose, out of the aura of the book, realized that this wasn't quite as simple as it seemed. And I wrote a poem in which I really wanted two voices, but they're both my own, at least in some sense. So we'll try to read it. If you keep that, give a man his manliness, provide creature comfort for him and herself, preserve essential hypocrisies, in short, make a home for herself, is going with this other line going against it. Wait for me. Give a man his, I said to her, manliness, provide what you want, I, creature comfort, want only for him and herself. More so, you preserve essential, think marriages, hypocrisies, everything, in short, make a, oh well, home for herself, I said. Come out at the right time, just a little behind.
I think that in his reading of those poems, you can see evidence of Creeley's interest in the line as a way of communicating the energy of the poem. A person who was a great influence on Creeley was the poet Charles Olson. And here's another tape which begins with a prose statement by Creeley about the importance to him of Charles Olson. He talks about his learning from Olson the notion of the line being measured in terms of the breath. Then we'll hear a reading of a Creeley poem called Le Fou, then a further prose statement, and finally a poem called The Crisis.
Charles Olson is a very important man in many senses, very much for me, because he, I think, was the man who most accurately and most helpfully told me things about measure and line in the poem that have proved for me personally very, very helpful. And I think it must have been about 1949 or 1950 that we first started corresponding. And roughly at that time, he published an article in a magazine called Poetry in New York called Projective Verse, which proved very, very useful. It was a sense of the line that I had not personally, or not myself, thought of, simply gauging the line's measure in terms of the breath that might be used to hold it. So this poem is dedicated to him, and is perhaps a metaphor or a descriptive image of my sense of his use of this. Le Fou, who plots them the lines, talking, taking always the beat from the breath, moving slowly at first, the breath, which is slow. I mean, graces come slowly. It is that way. So slowly they are waving. We are moving away from the trees, the usual, go by, which is slower than this, is we are moving, goodbye. And here's a poem of domestic content, and the only resolution of things I've ever found useful is one that comes from humor. So this is a poem of Song of Domestic Difficulties, The Crisis. Let me say in anger that since the day we were married, we have never had a towel where anyone could find it, the fact. Notwithstanding that I am not simple to live with, not my own judgment, but no matter. There are other things. To kiss you is not to love you, or not so simply. Laughter releases rancor. The quality of mercy is not strained. This poem was written from this domestic or marriage form. I've always been very confused, I suppose, or very interested as well, in no very simple sense, that when one is married and when one's wife is pregnant, carrying a child, it's a curious division. And so this, in effect, I suppose, expresses that complexity and that confusion, the riddle. What it is, the literal size incorporates. The question is a mute question. One is too lonely. One wants to stop there, at the edge of conception. The woman, imperative. The man, lost in stern thought. Give it form, certainly. The name entitles. The innocence. Looking to the sea, it is a line of unbroken mountains. It is the sky. It is the ground. There we live on it. It is a mist, now tangent to another quiet. Here the leaves come. There is the rock in evidence. Or evidence. What I come to do is partial, partially kept. The immoral proposition. If you never do anything for anyone else, you are spared the tragedy of human relationships. If quietly and like another time, there is the passage of an unexpected thing, to look at it is more than it was. God knows nothing is competent. Nothing is all there is. The unsure egoist is not good for himself.
I think it's difficult to avoid the feeling that Creeley's effects are deliberately slight. And this slightness, I think, reflects his distrust of what he calls a conclusive concluding. They reflect these effects reflect his belief that, as he says, nothing is competent, nothing is all there is. In an essay in one of the magazines, in which he is commenting on the work of some of his contemporaries, he very characteristically rejects any rhetoric which would try to take precedence over its subject and create more of an occasion than the subject warrants. What Creeley wants, he says, is the subject which, and I quote him, which remains volatile, free in its own term. Now, if Creeley represents the cool side, let's say, of the Bitcoin, where little, if anything, can be honestly affirmed, and that only provisionally, then Allen Ginsberg represents the hot side. His long oracular lines are a sort of open invitation to all kinds of writing, to some powerful metaphoric associations, some strong feeling, desperate humor, melodrama, and dull writing. In the endless effort to adjust occasion to subject, Creeley and Ginsberg employ opposite and extreme methods. Creeley, I should say, risking triviality in the interests of purity, and Ginsberg risking bombast in the interests of poetic power. Now, most practitioners of the new lyric mode pursue paths somewhere between these two extremes. Four of the most interesting and accomplished of these lyric writers seem to me to be James Wright, James Dickey, John Logan, and William Stafford. And I'll be talking about them, and we'll be listening to some of their poems in 4 weeks on Sunday, June 27th. That's the Sunday of the last week in June. I hope you'll be listening then. Good night.